You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 11th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we're jam-packed. Eric Cantor in a stunning upset. Hasn't happened since 1899, or actually didn't even happen before then, when they created the position of majority leader in the House. A majority leader goes down in a primary, losing by, what was it, 20 points? Unbelievable. The implications will reverberate through Congress and 2014, maybe 2016. Well, definitely 2016, maybe even 2014. On the program to discuss, Ryan Grimm from the Huffington Post. Peter Gazluska. He is from the alt weekly in Richmond, Virginia, called Style. And then, in the better half, we will talk to the chief correspondent of the Tea Party Network, Scotty Nell Hughes, on her reaction. We got the email. We said, okay, let's do it. We're jam-packed today, folks. I mean, as you know, I don't generally spend a lot of time on electoral politics. And hadn't anticipated talking about it at all today. We rejiggered stuff because this is a big deal. And it's fascinating. We can't quite figure out what happened here. And this is what we hope to figure out today when we talk to these people. It was not a turnout issue. There was significantly more, 50% more turnout in this election than in 2012, which is a presidential year. Cantor's vote total dropped from about 29,000, or I should say it dropped from almost 37,000 to about 29,000. Bratt, his challenger, a professor from a local college, his vote tally was about 36,000. Like I say, there was almost 20,000 more votes than in 2012. Turnout was up in every county in the district. 17,000 extra people vote show up to vote against. I mean, this is... and the cash... Cantor spent, I don't know, some portion of $5 million. I'm not exactly sure, but Bratt had... 200,000 and still has, I think, 80,000 on cash on hand. But let's just assume he spent the whole 200,000. I mean, there are a lot of different theories as to why this happened, not the least of which that Eric Cantor was just a jerk. I mean, just an a-hole. And people in his home district just got sick of him because there was some guy who could actually put together a couple of sentences. But, you know, we're going to dig into this today. It's a fascinating story. We'll be right back with Ryan Grimm.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, on an Amtrak train, I imagine, headed towards New York, but I don't know. Ryan Grimm. Ryan, thank you so much for getting on the train. We always like to mix things up here. And I wanted you moving while we talked.
Yeah, lousy day to be leaving Washington, though.
Yeah, indeed. All right. This is stunning by any sort of measure. Cantor's internal polling had him up 34 points. That seemed to have a pretty wide margin of error, or it didn't have a large enough one.
Right.
The Daily Caller apparently had a poll that had him up 11 points about a week ago. Give me your sense. I mean, we're hearing it's about immigration and this and that. I mean, as far as I can tell, it's just his district just thought Eric Cantor was a jerk at the very least. But this is sort of it seems bizarre to me. I mean, they 20,000 more votes on an off year election.
Yeah, don't underestimate the jerk factor. I think that had a lot to do with it. I mean, in his district, people just didn't like him. Somebody did a count of the number of tweets last night that included the phrase "I like Eric Cantor" and came up with something like two or three, which is astonishing for somebody whose career is ending.
Yeah,
you know, there's just no warmth out there for the guy, and this is somebody who drew his own district in 2010. You know, when they redistricted, so he really had no excuse here. And this is why I don't think he'll run a write-in, because there really isn't. I don't really see the path for him here. You know, his path was just to not get beaten in a Republican primary. So I really think that's a big part of it. There's some kind of Greek irony or whatever you'd want to call it here too, in that, you know, he really was the guy who embraced the Tea Party and leadership more than anybody else. You know, the Tea Party was defined by its opposition to everything, and Eric Cantor became part of that everything.
Yeah, you know, Brian Beutler had a piece that basically said that this was, what I've referred to in the past as, you know, Frankenstein's monster just running loose through the streets, and Frankenstein himself can't do anything about it.
I actually like the Hunt for Red October analogy, when those Russians accidentally blew their own submarine up, you know, trying to take the Americans out. I think that's exactly right. They couldn't control this beast that they fed and fueled.
Well, give me your sense. I mean, what about the Cooter effect from Dukes of Hazzard?
Yes.
Ben Jones. I mean, in other words, Ben Jones made a public call for people to cross party because this is an open primary. I mean, there were 20,000 extra votes. I just wonder, like, you know, that's a really motivated primary electorate.
It is. And, you know, there was no reason for Democrats to vote in their own primary because there was only one person running. So there was just been a waste of time for Democrats in that district to vote their own, so they could choose to jump over and vote against Eric Cantor in the Republican primary. And I've seen some people run some numbers that and been unconvinced that the Democrats, but I don't actually think that their analysis of the numbers is necessarily convincing. I don't know if they're looking at quite the right thing. There's no question that some people did that. The question that we'll probably never be able to answer is, you know, how many did it, and would he have won without it? I think it's pretty certain that he would have won this. He being Brett would have won this regardless of what Democrats did. But I think they certainly padded his victory.
Right, and I also wonder. I mean, here's a guy who has, I don't know if he had any ads on television. He didn't spend more than $120,000 from what I can tell. He still got $80,000 cash on hand. I don't know if there was
any. Cantor did it for him. Cantor spent $2 million trashing this guy as a professor who's too liberal for the district. And what that did is it made sure that every voter in the district knew that there was a serious alternative there, Cantor. So he might have even been better off if he didn't say a single word the whole time.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. I mean, because Jack Tramiel, who is going to be the Democratic opponent in the fall, is also a professor at the exact same college, right. Is presumably a liberal. So is this, I mean, is this going to be confusing for the electorate now? Like, which liberal professor are they going to vote for from this college when it comes to fall?
And if you're going to vote for a liberal professor, you might as well go all the way and pick the Democrat, right?
Well, I mean,
I think the only path for him, though, is if Cantor elects to mount some write-in campaign, which I don't think he will, because then what? You know, he will already have lost his majority leader spot. He's in the process of getting humiliated right now in the Capitol.
And is he that now? Does he automatically step down from that position, or is it just like nobody takes him seriously because he's not going to be around in January?
Right, it's not automatic, but you know, the conference can force the issue, and there are enough people already saying that they want to run against him that's enough to force the issue.
So who runs against him? I mean, now my understanding is that it has played out like this over the years. At first, Cantor was the sort of the Tea Party's guy in the caucus. He was fighting Boehner's attempts to forge a deal, you know, maybe the grand bargain or whatnot with President Obama. And then he sort of shifted and said, no, I'm a company man because I want to be the Speaker of the House. Boehner, you're going to retire so that you can go make a lot of money as a lobbyist and have, you know, instead of like 3-hour liquid lunches, you know, like 16-hour liquid lunches. So who ends up replacing him? And does Boehner now stay as Speaker of the House because the Chamber of Commerce is now terrified? I mean, what happens?
So immediately, Kevin McCarthy, who's the number three, he's a climber.
I'm sorry. Say his name. Say his name again. We lost you.
Kevin McCarthy.
Okay.
He's one of these teachers' pets from. He's from California. He's been a politician since he was like 12 years old. And he's one of those guys that nobody really likes. But people don't terribly dislike him, and he works hard. And, he's just kind of just steadily climbed his way through the ranks. So he's going to try to push from number three to number two. Pete Sessions is also going to run. He's a guy from Texas. He is not considered terribly strong either. It doesn't look. It's not clear if Jeb Hensarling is going to run. He would be the Tea Party favorite. He's the current Financial Services Committee chairman. He might run. If he doesn't, he's likely to run, you know, in January of 2015. But whatever happens in this round, it's just going to sow more confusion between now and January when the real kind of elections will happen, and that's when Boehner will have to decide whether or not he wants to, you know, take another ride in his clown car.
Now, McCarthy, my understanding is not terribly good when it comes to whipping votes. Is that
right.
Accurate?
No, nobody has any. I mean, in his defense, there are no earmarks anymore, and folks that were elected by the Tea Party, I would not want the task of having to try to round them up.
Right.
On the other hand, he is famously terrible at his job. So, you know, if he rises to number two, he's going to just kind of back into it.
So, okay. So now, legislatively speaking, right? This doesn't really make that much of a difference. I mean, I don't buy the notion that immigration reform was going to happen. Maybe. In the lame duck session, but there's no way, right? So, I mean, is this going to make a difference from a legislative standpoint, or are we going to see, like, there's going to be 10 more votes, 15 more votes to defund, you know, the Affordable Care Act?
Right.
I mean,
well, it's already, you know,
distinguish
it's already
for me,
June.
Distinguish for me the legislative potential versus what the political implications will be short run and in the run-up to 2014.
Right, so it's already June, so you weren't going to see much legislation happening between now and January anyway. And if you are going to, by some miracle, see immigration happen, let's say it happens in a lame duck or something, this doesn't make it any less likely. In fact, it even makes it more likely. Republicans realize they've got this toxic nuclear issue, and maybe they decide they want to get rid of it, the lame duck, and do something about it. But that doesn't have any immediate effect on legislation.
Are you there? Bear with us, folks. I asked Ryan to please be on a train today. We dropped him. All right, we'll pick him back up. I first asked Ryan to be on a plane, but that we couldn't work out in time. So
I'm back.
Okay, yeah. I was just explaining to people I had asked you to actually be on an airplane for this, but we couldn't work out the proper reservations. All right, so you were saying, so legislatively, I mean, maybe this makes immigration more likely in the lame duck, but unlikely. But what does it do to the politics?
Well, you know, it just drives, you know, it just drives everybody further to the right. If they can find any room on their right. I think the most substantial consequence is that next year the House is that much less governable because Eric Cantor was the guy that everybody relied on to bring the Tea Party around at the last minute. After Boehner tried everything he could think of to try to get some grand bargain or even a mini tiny bargain, when that was failed, they'd say, okay, well, let's just do this, and Eric, you go and round up enough Tea Party votes. Now they don't have anybody who can do that, nor do they necessarily have anybody who would want to do that, because they've seen what the personal consequence is of taking all those nicks every time you have to go back to the Tea Party and ask them to do something they don't want to do.
All right, well, Ryan, let me ask you this. Am I out of my mind to take some comfort that this is going to make let's just assume this scenario. The Senate is taken over by the Republicans. The president wants to make the grand bargain because now the Republicans are driving. Does this make that scenario less likely? In other words, because you've got Cantor out there, regardless of who replaces him, the wildly incompetent McCarthy or the lunatic Tea Party guys, does this change the calculation for the administration in the event that the Republicans take over the Senate? It no longer becomes Bill Clinton 1996?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is that much less of a chance for a grand bargain because that would involve raising taxes. And I don't see how, the new House would do that. Just for, you can basically forget about that. And also, the White House seems much less interested in that than they used to be. And they've lost all of their institutional support on the left for it. Even the Center for American Progress is now strongly against a grand bargain. And that's basically the extension of the administration.
Right. And so, I mean, I guess it's a fun... What do the Democrats do in terms of trying to nationalize this outcome, I guess, into 2014? I mean, do you think there's going to be any impact on these midterm elections?
No, I don't think so. I think this is, to the extent that anybody would care, it's mostly Democrats who are already paying close attention to politics. I don't really see how a normally informed voter is swayed one way or another on this. So maybe you can think of some way that they would be. I guess it makes them look a little crazier, but you have to be paying a lot of attention for that.
I think it's unlikely unless the sort of the Democrats then now, I don't know, I guess it doesn't change their plans in any way, right? I mean, in terms of promoting, immigration reform or anything else for that matter. I mean, I guess it's, but it certainly changes the politics within I wonder if it changes the way that Republicans are going to run in the fall in any fashion.
I don't necessarily think so because they know that their primary is a good way away from the general election. They have time to, and most of them are in very Republican safe districts anyway, so they're gonna throw their red meat around like they were going to anyway.
So Cantor's district is an R plus 10 in terms of the partisan index. Is this just too big of a mountain to climb? Assuming that Bratt, and I've heard him speak, is not going to start talking about rape or other issues.
Uh-huh.
Is this just too high of a mountain for Jack Tramiel to climb? Do you think the Democrats put any money in there or what?
Oh, I think anything's possible. I mean, it's still a very tough race for them. But he's not an evangelical, so he's less likely to, talk about legitimate rape, like you said. He's more of a libertarian.
He talks about God quite a bit, though. I got to tell you, this guy talks about God a lot. On Hannity, he did.
Yes, people don't know much about him, so who knows what comes out. When you have somebody who's just a completely kind of random guy thrown into the race and into the spotlight, anything's possible. Who knows what they could dig up about him. Same with Tramiel, of course.
Right. Good point. Well, Ryan Grimm, thanks for your time today. You can now get off at the next stop and head back to D.C. I appreciate you.
Sounds good.
I appreciate you getting on the train for us.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to talk to a local reporter from Richmond, Virginia. I'm just fascinated by this race. To see what happened. I mean, because there was no one who predicted any of this. This guy, Bratt, would win. Did I call him Bratton? I meant Bratt. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a second. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Peter Galeska, he is the contributing editor of Style Weekly in Richmond, Virginia, and he is part of the Washington Post local blog network. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, give us a sense. Did you see this this coming, that David Bratt would take down Eric Cantor, which is unprecedented, really, for a majority leader of the House to lose in a primary.
No, I didn't. I don't think many people did. People knew that David Bratt was mounting a very interesting and strong campaign, sort of an insurgent effort. But I don't think anyone expected not only a win, but a win this big.
So give me your sense of well, first off, this is what fascinates me. Where did these other 17,000 voters come from that didn't show up for the presidential on-year primary, but did for this one? I mean, who do you think those voters are?
Well, I think the Cantor camp came out immediately and said, you know, in Virginia, you don't have to, you know, vote by party in a primary. You just vote. You're in a district. You vote. And Cantor's people claim that a lot of Democrats are crossing over and just deliberately, you know, voting for Bratt. The Washington Post came out a story this morning that pretty much took that apart. However, I think what has been missed here by people like me, journalists, and others, is that there was a lot more resentment against Cantor than anyone realized. And a lot of it was led by the Tea Party. Of course, the Tea Party is a fairly disparate group. And but a lot of people just resented the same old, same old. They resented, you know, him being a big spender when he says he's not. They resented the, you know, the roadblocks in Congress, and just the whole game in Washington.
And so, and give me a sense of, like, you know, of how this message got out. I mean, there's, you know, people like Laura Ingraham and Mark Levin, these right-wing talk show hosts, they're claiming, obviously, that they had a big impact. I mean, did they? Do they have an affiliate? Are they particularly popular there? I mean, was that what drove people out?
I don't think so. I think it helped him. It helped Brad a lot, but I don't think that was the tipping point at all. Because, I mean, you can listen to any number of right-wing commentators like Rush Limbaugh, whatever. I think what happened, I think it's partly an unforced error on the part of Cantor, because Cantor ran some spectacularly negative and false ads against Bratt, claiming he was a, quote, liberal college professor, unquote, which would offend me, but I'm just saying is that it was wrong, because he's not. I mean, he's a pretty much of a libertarian, free market guy, and that's easily documented.
And you just don't want to be referred to as a college professor.
Well, no, I think it's the liberal part. I mean, Cantor was trying to claim that because some years ago that Bratt was a economic advisor to Democratic Governor Tim Kaine, and also was for Republican Governor Bob McDonnell, that somehow the Kaine part made him a, quote, liberal, which is a fighting word in some places here.
Yes.
And, that turned out to be totally false. And I think people realize that.
How? I mean, you know, did Bratt have ads up?
He did, too. And they countered it. And of course, it was the account was rebuffed in local media after a while. But, I just think that there's another point that I think we need to make here, too, is that Cantor lost touch with his constituents.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the main driver here, is that this was a guy who he took 233 flights on Delta over the past, I think it was year in his filings. How far away is Washington from his district by car?
About 90 miles.
Yeah, that would be a weird flight to take, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I know. Well, I think what's happened is there's several dynamics here locally that I think hurt Cantor a lot. One was he became House Majority Leader. He became more distant and estranged from his constituents. That was one issue. Another issue, there are stories about him. I mean, he would always show up at his local offices here with bodyguards and black suburban SUVs, and there's just stories about how people would be shoved out of the way, they would park wherever they wanted to, and Cantor just seemed more like the Imperial Washington.
Interesting.
And that story got around.
Now, what can you tell me about Jack Tramiel? He is a professor at the same college as David Bratt.
Right.
Is this going to be a race between two liberal college professors?
I don't think so. I think you might be able to say that Trammell is probably more progressive than Brat, but Brat is actually quite conservative. And I think Trammell, I don't know much about him, frankly, but he's a sociology instructor and has written a number of books at Randolph-Macon. And, of course, Brat is the chair of the Economics and Business Department at Randolph-Macon and is well known for, you know, liking people like Rand, Hayek, people like that. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting, although I wouldn't think that Trammell would have a prayer of winning in this district.
It's a heavily Republican district. I mean, Cantor himself sort of redrew the lines, ostensibly, I guess, to protect him from a Democratic challenge, maybe never anticipating a Republican challenge that would work.
I think that's about right. And, you know, but another thing, and I think another point here is it's very Richmond in a sense, because if you look at the numbers, the people who really turned were from the wealthy, mostly white suburban areas like Henrico, Chesterfield, and Hanover counties around Richmond. And, you know, there just sort of seems to be this thing where the old Richmond order, you know, Cantor was actually a product of the Richmond business establishment, very well-respected family in real estate. And he was Tom Bliley, a former Republican congressman's protege. And, you know, Bliley was his mentor and set him up. And I think over time that is changing. People are getting tired of being, like the local paper, the Richmond Times-Dispatch, was always promoting Cantor. At one point, its former company, Media General, had his wife, Cantor's wife, Diane, on its board, which raised a lot of eyebrows, too. Cantor could do no wrong. And eventually people get tired of that. And they also got tired of Cantor claiming that he is a budget hawk when he voted for just about every budget-busting bill George Bush could come up with.
But I guess it, that's 6 years later, right? I mean, he pays the price. Let me ask you this. Today, apparently, David Brat was on MSNBC and announced that he hadn't crafted a position on the minimum wage. And a lot of people are raising their eyebrows because here's, like you say, the chair of an economics department doesn't have a position on the minimum wage. I mean, what is this guy ready for prime time? I mean, let me ask you this. Do you believe that?
No, I don't believe it, number one. And number two, but I tell you one thing that I have blogged about that I've been critical of some of Brat's writings, in that, of course, he really nailed Cantor on amnesty for undocumented immigrants. And I applaud Cantor for trying to get some kind of resolution on that. And Brat was playing kind of a really hardball, anti-immigrant, nativist kind of thing. And Brat was claiming that, you know, these immigrants, read Hispanics, are taking jobs away from Americans. Well, if you know the district, you know that's kind of nonsense, which is basically a lot of rural areas, north and west of Richmond, and the wealthy suburbs. So it's kind of silly.
Now, so let me ask you this. My understanding is that the polling that's been done in that district show there's about 70 to 75% favorable for immigration, some type of comprehensive immigration reform. Do you think that that Brat is vulnerable in that position? I mean, he's taken, like you say, a pretty nativist stance on this. Do you think that this is something where Trammell may start to hit him a little bit?
Well, I think so. I think that this whole bringing up the amnesty thing after so many years, you know, I thought we'd been through this before, you know, that this is giving the Democrats a new opportunity. It will push back any kind of congressional resolution, I think. I'm not a Washington expert or anything, but, you know, on the immigration issue. But I do think this does give Democrats and people like Trammell a ready issue. Because you're right. I think a lot of people say, no, wait a minute, we need to resolve this in some compassionate and reasonable way, you know?
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and I appreciate your coming on and giving us a local perspective on this, because I think there's a lot of people outside of that district who are trying to figure this out, and I think, stunning for a lot of people.
It certainly is. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Peter. All right, folks. Wow. So there you have it. I mean, we did this almost like a real news show. Right? I figure once every couple of weeks, maybe once every quarter, we'll do something like this, where we got the local perspective, the Washington perspective, and then when we go into the funner half of the program, we'll get the more sort of like interterrestrial perspective. What's the word I'm looking for?
Interterrestrial.
The non-terrestrial perspective.
The post-terrestrial.
Here's what I found interesting about the idea of spinning this as this is a Tea Party win. I have been saying for years, and I am looking right now at the book that came out in 06, but I wrote it in 05. And the premise of FUBAR, America's right-wing nightmare, can be summed up thusly. The Republican Party is not your father's Republican Party. Now probably your grandfather's Republican Party. What was marginal back in the day has now taken over the party. There's no Tea Party, and even like Hannity last night was talking about, like, this doesn't have to be, you know, Ronald Reagan never ran as a third party. We can take over this party. Look, they've already taken it over. And it's this victory is not an indication of that at all. I think this win by this David Brat, like we just heard from this local reporter, was really more about Eric Cantor being a grade A jerk-off and treating the local people like they were local yokels from Virginia, and he's way up in Washington, D.C. And even David Brat had this to say to Sean Hannity when Hannity was trying to work out this whole Tea Party angle. This is what David Brat had, and I think it's accurate. This is number two. This is on the Sean Hannity program last night.
Oh, this is one you sent me?
Yes, number two.
We have an issue where Eric Cantor went to the Seacoast earlier this year, and he was going to battle the Tea Party. What is your take on the relationship and what it needs to be between the Tea Party and the establishment?
Yeah, well, the grassroots, the Tea Party, and the Republican Party all share almost identical principles. And, you know, I went to seminary, I think you did.
Yes.
Also,
I did.
Before I did
they
my PhD
me out,
in economics, right? Yeah.
And so, they wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, principles matter, right?
And we kept that part about the seminary as he's going into talking about economics because I think a lot of his work is sort of fantastical, like a lot of libertarian stuff. And it's very much probably akin to his religion. Now, I think it's unlikely that the Democrat is going to win in this race, but it's conceivable. It would be fascinating to follow this guy's career. I mean, he'll be out in 2 years, right? He's in, he's out.
Definitely. Although, is that actually... if he goes there and he just performs and kind of puts his head down as a right wing kind of backbencher,
I think Cantor will go after him again. Oh no,
I
don't think Cantor will run again. They'll find another Chamber of Commerce guy, maybe.
But this guy could be a Chamber of Commerce guy. What I'm saying.
Well, that's the point. Is that let's not forget that this is a guy who has been blasting apparently the banks on TARP and saying, Eric Cantor voted for TARP. Well, David Brat's work at Randolph-Macon College, he is the chair of the economics department, but he's also the director of the BB&T Moral Foundations of Capitalism program. What is BB&T? It is apparently a bank chaired by John Allison IV, who is the president and CEO of the Cato Institute. You know, those guys who really don't like bailouts. There's no bailout for banks or car companies or anybody. His bank accepted a $3.1 billion bailout through its sale of preferred shares to the U.S. Treasury's Troubled Asset Relief Program back in 2008. Ah, bygones. We had one time where we took a $3 billion bailout. Just one time.
Jack Elaine eats a friggin' donut. All of a sudden, the guy's not healthy.
That's
Jesus,
right.
Come, come on.
The this also was really stunning. I referenced it to the local reporter. He didn't seem to be aware of it. I hope I didn't get that into the bloodstream of the local politics. Because this is rather embarrassing, or it's a total lie. Here is David Bratt on Chuck Todd's MSNBC program this morning, where apparently he said at one point, like, I didn't expect all these questions. I thought I was just going to talk about winning. This is number one.
Other issue questions. We've talked a lot about immigration, for instance. Where are you in the minimum wage? Do you believe in it, and would you raise it?
Minimum wage, no, I'm a free market guy. Our labor markets right now are already distorted from too many regulations. I think Cato estimates, you know, there's $2 trillion of regulatory problems. And then throw Obamacare on top of that. The work hours is 30 hours a week.
Yeah.
You can only hire, you know, 50 people. There's just distortion after distortion after distortion, and we wonder why our labor markets are broken.
So should there be a minimum wage, in your opinion?
Say it again?
Should there be a minimum wage, in your opinion?
I don't have a well-crafted response on that one. All I know is if you take the long-run graph over 200 years of the wage rate, it cannot differ from your nation's productivity, right? So you can't make up wage rates, right? I would love for everyone in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, children of God, to make $100 an hour, right? I would love to just assert that that would be the case, but you can't assert that unless you raise their productivity.
Yeah, what happened to the economics professor who didn't realize that productivity has increased by almost, I think, 100% from where the minimum wage was back in 1968? Maybe more. I mean, this guy, and you can hear it, you know, like where he's talking about, like, if you play that first part of it again, this is basically a word salad. This is just another.
He's listening to his students. He's been in enough classrooms.
No,
like,
well, he's just getting the Cato.
Because like, Africa.
He's just getting the Cato talking points, and that is it. This guy's another. Boy, I'll tell you, he would never do it in a million years. But I would love to debate this guy and get another, hey, shut up. All right, folks, look, we're going to head quickly into the better half of the program. When we come back, we're going to be talking to this reporter, the chief correspondent of the Tea Party News Network. And, folks, become a member today at majority.fm, and you can enjoy this type of stuff. See you tomorrow. Yeah.